Buenos dias und herzlich willkommen bei Gate 7, deinem Podcast über Fernweh und Fotografie. In dieser Show geht es um Menschen, für die Reisen mehr ist als Spaß und Erholung. Freue dich auf praktische Tipps und Tricks, wie du tief in fremde Kulturen eintauchst und lerne, deine Abenteuer in bewegenden Bildern festzuhalten, egal mit welcher Kamera. Bist du bereit? Dann los, lass uns abheben mit deinem Gastgeber, Kai Beermann.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gate 7 podcast, where it's all about travel and photography. Well, it usually is about travel photography, but today is a little bit different. My guest today is US-based documentary photographer Jason Coxwold, and with Jason I'm going to talk about his series called Knives. Knives is a long-term documentary project in which Jason explores the impact of the closure of the Schrade knife factory on the people in a rural town called Wawarsing in New York. It's a blueprint of what happens on a larger scale, not just in the US, but in a globalized world when production is moved to countries where labor is cheaper and people feel left behind. As I mentioned, this conversation is not about travel photography, but nonetheless, I think you'll be able to extract a lot of information from this interview that you can then apply to other fields of photography, such as travel photography, for example. In this interview, you learn how to find a subject for a long-term photo project, how to tackle the process of putting together a coherent series, what it means to document life in a small town where everybody knows you, and how photography can help you to become more observant and to make sense of the world around you. These are all things that are not just tied to documentary photography dealing with political, economic, or social issues. They can also be applied to travel photography, meaning that if you want to, or if you're interested in telling a story in more than just a single frame, I think you'll be able to find enormous value in this conversation and in the things that Jason tells about how he went about putting together this project called Knives. What I find so fascinating about Knives is that it's a very multi-layered project. It's not just about knives. In essence, it's also about the struggle of white men to adapt to a new reality, and ultimately also about the rise of Donald Trump to the presidency of the US. And ultimately, Knives is an exploration of capitalism. Jason says, "The value of labor is not just financial. There's a great deal of importance we place on it as we shape our own self-identity." Knives is a beautiful example of how photography can be deployed to make social issues visible. It's an in-depth visual exploration of the changes happening around us as capitalism is marching on. I hope you will enjoy this episode, and once again, please excuse that it's a little bit off topic. I know it's going to be different from what you're used to on this podcast. Nevertheless, I am very sure that it's worth your time. With that being said, just one quick reminder before we jump into the interview with Jason, and that is, please make sure to also check out my other photography website, which is called The Art of Creative Photography. You'll find it at artofcreativephotography.com. And on that site, I provide, or you find interviews with different photographers from all around the world, from all sorts of genres, sharing their secrets and giving advice and helping you to become a better visual artist. So now, without further ado, let's get into the interview with Jason Coxwold. Hello, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's thank you for taking the time to do this interview. It's I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your new series or most recent one. It's called Knives. It's it's a long-term project and a good example for your way of working. You are a photographer, specialized in these kind of long-term projects, and this is a very, very interesting one. So I'm really looking forward to digging into the details of that. But before we start, Jason, why don't you introduce yourself briefly? Who are you, and what got you into photography?
Sure. So I am a European, essentially. I grew up in England mostly, I've got Norwegian and Italian parents, and I've been making photographs sort of in this vein for probably about 10 or 12 years now. I began using large format cameras, mostly 4x5, and continued with that in a series of long-term projects, the first of which explored kind of the topography of globalization. Then I began a war project that was also on large format film, but has now transitioned to digital medium format. And while I was working on that, I stumbled upon the story that became the book that is Knives, which is really about the current state of play, I think, in the United States. I mean, it's specific to the United States in every regard. But I think it touches on challenges that people are feeling all around the world right now. So those are sort of the three major projects I've been working on through the last 12 years.
Yeah. Before you got into photography, you studied a different career, right? You didn't study photography.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I went to university to study psychology and social science. So I think those things really inform a lot of the way I approach my work as a photographer. That is to say, I'm really interested in these kind of socioeconomic forces that shape our lives and how to bring that to life in a frame, as it were, you know, in the photographic frame. With regard to photography, I'm mostly self-taught. I've assisted with a few larger name photographers, and they very much helped me sort of refine my voice as I was finding the stories I was trying to tell. But yeah, academically speaking, I studied psychology primarily.
Yeah, but it provides a very good background, as to what psychology and socioeconomic, things that they tie very beautifully in with your photography, with your work as a photographer right now. They provide kind of the backdrop for all your work you're doing with the camera.
I like to think so. You know, everything I dig into begins as kind of the seed of an idea, something that I might be feeling or wondering about, and then I dig into it. So, you know, there's a lot of research involved with the work, whether it be sort of geographical research that I use Google Earth for, that I use a lot of Wikipedia for, but also in terms of the, you know, understanding the story behind these things, and especially in the case of knives, really beginning to dig into the backstories of the people who made these knives and how that's similar in many ways to the people all over the United States who are watching industry evaporate as things become more automated or as things become more outsourced to other countries.
Well, you mentioned it, knives. It's centered around the closure of a knife factory or manufactory. I think it occurred in 2004. What's the town called?
So the town is called Wawarsing. It's in the upstate New York area, the Hudson Valley area. It happens that I built a house there in about 2010. And it's interesting. It's almost impossible to ignore the wreckage, the ruins of the factory as you drive through the town. But I never really thought too much about it. The region has, I think, over 150 years of knife-making history. Some of the first craftsmen moved over from Sheffield in the United Kingdom in the 19th century. And that began, you know, a number of different businesses that grew and changed hands and were bought over a very long period until most of that industry consolidated into the hands of one large company called Schrade, which made knives for the army, for the FBI, for hunters. They made utility knives, all kinds of stuff. And until 2004, they had essentially a booming business that was, like many others, under this great pressure to grow and deliver return to its owners and its shareholders. And essentially what happened was it ended up eating itself, if you will. The pressure that some of the buyers like Walmart and Kmart put them under to deliver more and more knives for lower and lower profits, I think, became the challenge. And so in 2004, they closed their doors. On that day, they laid off, I think, 270 people. Mm-hmm. But at their peak, they'd had 750, I believe, working in one location. So that sort of shockwave rippled out through the town. And what started to happen was, as suddenly you had people with no disposable income to spend, now the hairdressers were going out of business. Now the car repair companies were going out of business. And steadily the town fell into this fairly depressing state of disrepair, which they have yet to fully recover from. That's the story of a Worsing in a nutshell.
Yeah. How many people live there?
What a great question. I think it's about 10,000.
Okay. Yeah. So huge impact. And if there's a factory giving so much work to so many people, and of course, as you described it, if that goes out of business, people don't have money to spend, and it affects all the businesses in that place. Big impact. When did you first realize that you could that this could grow into a project? You said you moved to that place or in that area. Was there a specific incident when you realized that it could be a project, or was it more a gradual thing?
Both. So I had kids 3 years ago. I had one who's now three, and I just had another 8 months ago. And what that means in terms of the way I was able to work was, rather than necessarily going away, you know, whereas in the past I would travel to China or Nigeria or wherever the story may be to shoot my work, now I have to stay a lot closer to home, just in terms of, you know, playing the role I wanted to be able to play as a father and not be distant from my family all the time. So I started photographing this story, and it grew slowly for a long time, probably over the course of about a year. Then in October, I suppose it was, November of 2015, when Donald Trump was elected. Was that 15 or 16? God, it's so hard to keep track anymore. Actually 16, I think.
16, yeah.
Yeah. I was standing on the flight line at a military base in Kuwait, or the United Arab Emirates, and nobody in the United States, I think Donald Trump least of all, expected him to become president. And so on that day, while I was halfway through this other very large, very slow-moving project about military occupation, suddenly it became clear to me that whatever wound the United States was suffering was more than just a surface wound. It went really deep. It went deep enough that citizens of the country were willing to take a radical step to try and change their circumstances. And that had a relevance to the story I was trying to tell with Knives. So immediately I sort of put the military project on pause and started focusing on Knives as a more urgent thing for me to explore, because it suddenly had relevance on a much larger scale than I had previously imagined.
Ah, okay. So you already had begun, you had some pictures, but it was more about documenting the circumstances in that town without thinking so much about the consequences or about what other or how that is tied into a bigger picture. And then Donald Trump became president, and you kind of connected the dots and saw that there's much more to the project.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. I saw a great quote the other day, said, "We need to stop talking about how people feel left behind and start talking about how people are left behind." And I think even as, you know, presidents, including Clinton and Bush and Obama and now Trump, talk about the economy of the country being in great shape, that's not true for most of the people in the country. I think it is true from any sort of numerical, objectively observed point of view, that the wealthy have become much wealthier and the poor have become much poorer. And when people say that unemployment is down, that statement, I think, it can be passed in a couple of ways. One is that we stop counting people as unemployed when they stop trying. Mm. And there's something really interesting about the notion of ceasing to try. I don't know how you stop trying to make a living. I don't know what you do when you can no longer make a living, but that's a very powerful thought to me. And then, of course, the other side of things is that larger employers like McDonald's, like Amazon, deliberately hire people on a part-time basis in order to avoid paying for their healthcare and their benefits. And so that obviously has a very big effect on what it means to be a citizen of a country that you can't afford to live in, essentially.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the town at this point? How much or how high is the unemployment rate? And have people who used to work in the factory, in the knife factory, what kind of other jobs have they found, or where did they move from there?
That's a great question. I'm honestly not sure what. Well, actually, you know what? It says the unemployment rate in Ellenville is 4%, which doesn't sound shockingly bad. Mm. I would counter that probably doesn't reflect the actual number. In terms of what people have done, it's a great question because the local newspaper has attempted to discover where people have dispersed to or what they're doing. And what's interesting is that nobody really wants to talk about it. So what I found as I was researching my book and making my photographs was that when I was looking for people who used to work in the knife factory, they were very hard to find. But once I stopped looking for specifically that, once I stopped asking, hey, can you introduce me to anyone who may have worked in the factory, I started just finding them accidentally. Once I started photographing people I stopped on the street, a great many of them would say to me, oh, yeah, I used to work in the knife factory, and now, you know, they repair lawnmowers. One of the guys repairs lawnmowers. You got school bus drivers. There's a, you know, the largest employer in the town right now is the maximum security prison. And so several of the people have gone to work there. But of course, inside the prison, and this ties into the work you see in the book too, it's very hard to get any visibility into a closed ecosystem like a prison. And so while the New York Department of Corrections were quite helpful, well, were as helpful as they could legally be in terms of giving me access to the prison, it was still very difficult to really get an accurate picture of how many people work there, what goes on there, and so forth.
Hmm. Yeah. What do you think? Work, yeah, or many people, their work is a big factor. It can kind of define you as a person, and it can give you security. And when that, goes away, maybe they fall into a hole. What do you think is, on a psychological level, what this meant to the people in that town, losing their jobs then and seeing their factory being sold abroad, and what were the implications of that?
That's a really good question. I think the value of work, the value of labor, right, is as you mentioned, it's not just financial. There's a great deal of importance we place on it as we shape us, our own self-identity. Mm-hmm. And so when that goes away and the question becomes, who do you blame for this malaise? I think it's one of the reasons why you see a rise in racial aggression within the United States. And even looking at the conversations that a lot of the guys had who used to work at the knife factory, they actively resent the Chinese people who are now making these knives, despite the fact that the Chinese person now making the knives has no context and no concept of who was previously doing that job, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you offer a person a job and they need the money, they won't turn it down. They're not going to turn it down on principle because that job once belonged to a middle-class worker in upstate New York. So in some regard, or in every regard, the specific people who are the targets of this racial aggression didn't do anything necessarily to deserve it. So there's something interesting to me in there about, Well, who is to blame? Is it the man who profited greatly by selling the company? Is it the man who profited greatly by buying the company and then reducing his costs to the bare minimum? I believe he just recently sold the company for $82 million or thereabouts to Smith & Wesson, the gun manufacturer. And that is never discussed, I think, as like what is to blame for this situation, despite the fact that it happens in towns all over the United States.
Well, some people, when they lose their jobs, they just well, as to their best ability, they try to move on, find a new job, and then there's others who, who lose track completely and turn to drugs and maybe violence. How has that, or have you observed that in that town, that violent drug part?
Yes, that's definitely true. There was, at the end of the book, there was a lady I photographed with her very young daughter. She was homeless, living out of a motel. And I think her face kind of bore the scars of drug use to some degree. But more interestingly than that, you know, behind us, ambulances and police cars were going past, you know, with some regularity. And I said to her, "What's the story with these ambulances?" And she said, "Oh, those are drug overdoses." And I said, "Is that fairly normal for a Friday night?" And she said, "No, that's normal for every night of the week." So, yes, I think the incidence of opioid abuse has increased in the town, as it has across the rest of the United States. And now that police and ambulance workers are carrying with them Narcan, which is the how would you call it? The antidote that can save the life of someone who's having an opioid overdose. They're saying that they'll save someone's life on a Friday and then they'll have to do it again within a week. I heard stories of multiple times in a day to having to revive people who are overdosing, the same person overdosing. So that to me speaks of a sort of level of desperation that was previously not felt. As for violence, I don't know that the violent crime in the town has increased necessarily. I think I'm more aware of it as a exercise in self-harm, if that makes any sense.
Turning it inward, the hurt or the loss of your job and what comes with that. You mentioned that it was difficult for you to get in touch with people you used to work in the factory. Can you talk a little bit about how you went about actually shooting the project and making the photographs? How did you find your or people to photograph, and how did you go about looking for the images that would fit into that series?
In terms of the portraiture, I approached it sort of much like I would approach other projects, in that you start with a person you know and then you sort of branch out from there to find other people. You ask them who they might know, or in many cases, you know, for example, the guy who fixes lawnmowers, he fixed my lawnmower. He had a wonderful face, and I asked him if he would mind if I made his portrait. And he said no. Similarly, there was another guy who said no, he wouldn't mind, just to be clear. Another guy was working on my car, and he had a remarkable face, and I asked him to sit, and he did. And in doing so, you know, while I was shooting the image, some of his colleagues were behind me and they shouted over my shoulder, like, "Hey, smile." And he said, "No, that's not the kind of photograph he's looking for." And I thought that was really interesting in terms of people understanding what it was I was trying to do. A lot of the time when you ask someone to be photographed, I think they assume that you want them to smile. They assume that you want to paint a very positive picture. Or on the flip side, if they detect that that's not what you're trying to achieve, sometimes there's some hostility there, some question of, well, why are you trying to make this town look bad? And I think what was interesting was that people were quite happy just to sit quietly and understood that it wasn't an attempt to smear the town. It was more an attempt to understand the town and understand the circumstances in which they found themselves. So I was really grateful for that. Then in terms of the landscapes that went along with, it just reached a point where every time I drove anywhere, I would take my camera and my tripod with me, because you never know. Right? The one thing I can say with certainty is if you don't have your camera, a photograph will absolutely appear that you will miss. So it would kind of drive my wife and children crazy, but I would be stopping regularly to shoot landscapes.
Yeah. Yeah, talking about the portraits, you said that one of the fears that some people had was that maybe your intention was to give the town a bad name. How does that affect your work or living in that community? Does that make a difference, knowing the people, seeing them on a daily basis, or just coming or shooting a project, coming to a place that you leave again after some time?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think that the template that many photographers use is to sort of embed themselves into a place, work for whether it be a week, 2 weeks, a month, and then leave again, maybe return to continue the story. But essentially, they don't have to live necessarily with the consequences of their actions. Mm-hmm. So there was definitely a part of me that was quite concerned as the book was completed that it might make my life harder. In the process of researching some of the stories, I spent a few days working at the Ellenville Library, and the head librarian said, "Oh, I've heard about you." And I said, "Oh, what did you hear?" She said, "Nothing." And there was definitely there was some implied, I don't know quite what the word would be, not threat, but slightly intimidating sense that yes, people are talking, and no, they're not talking about how excited they are to see the book. So yeah, there was definitely some nervousness on my part. And it hasn't yet manifested itself in anything in terms of my day-to-day interactions with people. It may also be worth mentioning that, you know, I grew up in the UK. I built a house in a working class town. I think that I will always probably be an outsider there. So maybe I had nothing to lose in that regard. Hard to say.
Yeah. How was the book received now that it came out? Have you gotten any reactions to that?
Yeah, it's been really well received. It was my first book. It's always hard to know when you make a book what the demand is going to be like. But so far, we've sold about half of our stock. It's for sale in shops in Europe, in Japan, in Australia, across the United States. And it's received some really positive reviews. So I do follow pretty closely how it's being received, and we do try and put it in magazines where we can. I'm happy with that. I have no complaints about that. And it's provided a springboard for us to be able to make more books. So I just recently published a book for another photographer, Shane Rochelot, called You Are Masters of the Birds and Fishes and All the Animals. And we have three more books in the works, one for a Dutch photographer, one more for me. So hopefully the success of that first book will continue to sort of allow future projects to thrive.
Mm. Sort of as a springboard.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, great. And locally, has there been some coverage in local newspapers or television channels or on the radio? Was it received there as well, or
Sure, yeah. The local newspaper picked it up and ran a story about it. It's always interesting talking to people who don't live in the world of photography the way photographers do and the way sort of gallerists do. They gravitate towards different criteria of ways of discussing the work. But yeah, they received it positively. It's been picked up in some local galleries and bookstores. So yes, it is. It has a life within the community. I don't know whether it's being actively discussed on an ongoing basis. Part of me hopes it's not. but it does raise this really interesting question about representation. And Stanley Wallachow and Amber, who wrote the essay that accompanied the book, made a really salient point, and I'll just quote it directly. He says, "We should do away with any notion that those of us who read this book are in a position to confer recognition on those represented within it. Similarly, we should also do away with the notion that's deeply embedded in much of the history of documentary photography, that those people shown in these pages seek anything from us as their audience. To fail at this is to risk further entrenching a set of antagonisms that have been dangerously weaponized in the very recent past." So that question of representation and who is the audience for this book is really interesting. And living in the town, that presents an ongoing tension for me. Knowing that by photographing these characters, you are in some way judging them or inviting others to judge them when they never asked to be judged. They were quite happy living their lives before a photographer came along and replicated their likeness in a beautifully printed book. So yes, on an ongoing basis, I do sort of struggle with the question of how to live within the environment that I'm photographing. I certainly don't think it made me any more popular in the town, but hopefully it didn't make me any less popular either.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a very interesting topic. Did you revisit with the people you took a portrait of? Did you show them the final book? Did you have a chance to talk with them and see how they received it?
Some, but not all. You know, some of them have moved on. The lady in the motel, for example, I don't think she lives there anymore. But yeah, where I could, I followed up with the people in the book, and it's interesting. I've been witness to a great many people I've photographed over the years, and even when I'm photographed, we are very vain about assessing our own image. But the people in the book that I've shown the photographs to seem to think that, you know, that they're not unhappy with the way they're represented. And I think that gives me some peace of mind in that you want to represent someone in the most honest way you can. It's certainly not my intent to make them look bad. But at the same time, I'm not trying to airbrush them into looking like, you know, larger than life, or, you know, especially in this era of Instagram filters and Snapchat filters that programmatically make us look better than we do. I try as hard as I can to avoid any of that and to present people in the most honest way possible.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Before you mentioned that some people, they didn't quite understand the concept of documentary photography, which is very different from having their portrait taken on other occasions, where it's more about looking the best they can and looking pretty, and this is just a more maybe a harder look at reality that you were going for in your series.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true.
Mm. Jason, how do you think this example of this town that you shot your series in is representative for the rest of the country? And we've touched on that this is a very multi-layer project. In what way does this scale throughout the rest of the country?
Mm. Yeah. I've seen a number of projects that tackle similar questions in a similar way from other parts of the country. So clearly, well, Warsing is not the only place that's feeling this pain. And if anything, you know, while to me as a in quotes liberal, what I see in my own town may not be ideal in terms of this rise of racism, this rise of misogyny. It's better by my criteria than elsewhere. There are places that have been living in similar circumstances for 20 and 30 years now in terms of the Rust Belt, places where cars were made, where steel was made. Those industries went away, I think, a lot earlier than industry went away in Ellenville. And it's one of the reasons why there is still a sort of net increase in migration to big cities. Because if I were raising children in a town like this, my question would be, well, what's left for them? What can they do that could guarantee them an income? So yes, it is a common story. And I think that migration that I mentioned also helps to create a barrier between the rural economies and the urban economies that results in one of the reasons why you see, for example, on the coasts, people voting more for Democrats, and in the center of the country, not by much. You know, all you have to do is go 100, 200 miles inland, and suddenly the whole demographic makeup changes, and people vote for very different reasons than they do on the coasts. So, yes. Sorry, go on.
Yeah. You said that one question that you ask yourself is what will your children possibly do when they grow up? What kind of jobs will there be for them? Are there any other questions that you like people to ask themselves looking at your picture or looking at this project?
I think for me, one of the interesting questions is how we deliberately or not help to create the circumstances that I've documented in this book. So, when we make decisions about where we shop and how we shop, for example, I certainly don't intend for the book to be a lesson in any regard. I certainly don't think that my way of living is necessarily the right way. But I think we're all aware that if we shop at places like Amazon and Walmart, that we are further cementing those inequalities within the United States. And indeed, within a global economy too, because they transcend local politics at this point. So that's one of the questions that I like to sit with as I revisit the book. And I think another one is it's very hard to say without sounding like a typical liberal, potentially hypocritical viewer, when you look at places that vote for, in my opinion, right-wing interests, even as they suffer from the wounds that those decisions create, the notion of voting against your own interests is really interesting to me, because I think that fundamentally people blame the wrong people for the circumstances they find themselves in. We champion in this country the American dream, which I think is very much a dream for most, quite unattainable. Mm. We champion people who've become extraordinarily wealthy. That wealth has to come from somewhere. And in my experience, in my opinion, typically, it comes from the pockets of the working man, if you will, by paying working men and women less and less, that allows capital to flow upwards. And in doing so, further cements this inequality that I keep coming back to. So that, I think, is a really important question to ponder. And I ponder it all the time, not least because I do so from a position of some level of privilege. And so I kind of have to weight that as in the way I think about these things, you know?
Yeah. Great points. You mentioned that you're basically a self-taught photographer. What are your reference points? Are there other photographers that you look up to that influenced your way of photographing?
There are, for sure. I try to differentiate the work from theirs as much as I can, but I'm a big fan of people like Victoria Sembonaris, Taryn Simon. I'm trying to think who else, you know, Mitch Epstein, and they approach the documentary discipline in very different ways, I think. But each of them has taught me a lot, indirectly. Yes.
Mm. Well, Jason, where can people find out more about you on the internet? Like we've talked about your images, where is a good place to have a look at the images?
Sure, yeah. I have most of them on my website, which is coxfold.com. That's my primary way of getting work out there. Obviously, I also use Instagram. My Instagram handle is Cox, K-O-X. Those are probably the best places to keep abreast of it, and I definitely appreciate people taking a look when they can.
Great. I'll also link to the sites in the show notes to this episode. And well, it's been a pleasure talking to you about knives and about your way of working as a documentary photographer. It's been, very, very insightful. Thank you very much for your time, Jason.
Thank you, Kai. I really appreciate the interview.
Well, bye-bye.
Thanks.